Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mary Grace Payden for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Religion in the News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Religion News Service. The first article, published on May 26, is entitled, Charges Reduced for Indigenous Peoples 5 and Toppling of Junipero Serra Statue, by Alejandra Molina. Nearly 3 years after five protesters were charged with felony vandalism for toppling and spray painting a Junipero Serra statue in Northern California, the Marin County District Attorney's Office announced on May 25 that the case had been resolved, with charges reduced from felonies to misdemeanors. Under the agreement, defendants must pay monetary restitution to the church for the repair or replacement of the statue, complete 50 hours of volunteer work, apologize in writing in an official court record, and participate in the upcoming community meeting with a historian to engage in meaningful dialogue about the issue. The defendants must also stay off the church property. Since the toppling of the statue at Mission San Rafael Archangel in San Rafael in the fall of 2020, more than 80,000 have signed a petition urging District Attorney Lori Frugoli to drop the charges against them. The incident occurred during a demonstration on Indigenous Peoples Day to protest the colonization of Native Americans, according to news reports. Images show the statue was knocked down and sprayed with red paint. While Serra, an 18th century Franciscan priest and Catholic saint, is credited with spreading the Catholic faith in what is now California, critics say he was part of an imperial conquest that enslaved Native Americans. The defendants, who have become known as the Indigenous Peoples Five, participated in a restorative justice process while the case made its way through the court system, the district attorney's office said. Marin County District Attorney Lori Frugoli said a resolution came after a thorough case review by prosecutors and a long discussion among church members, community members, legal counsel for the defendants, and the defendants' participation in the restorative justice process. While this issue has raised emotions because of the sensitivities around religion, community boundaries, and historic inequities, the fact is that a resolution through accountability has been reached through restorative justice, and that is a victory for this community, Frugoli said. Not everyone agrees. San Francisco Archbishop Salvatore J. Cordiglione, in a letter on May 24, said he was disturbed but not surprised by the decision to reduce the charges against the five defendants. You have given the signal that attacks on Catholic houses of worship may continue without serious legal consequence, Cordiglione said in the letter addressing the district attorney. Cordiglione applauded the felony charges in 2020 as a breakthrough moment for Catholics after urging the district attorney to press charges to the full extent of the law. He also pressed for hate crime charges to be filed. Now Cordiglione says the archdiocese was shut out during the restorative justice process, adding that the mediator in the case treated the perpetrators as if they were the victims. The point is, a felony crime was committed. The law does not allow people to trespass onto private property and destroy it, all the more so when the private property is a house of worship and the property being destroyed has sacred value to the members of the congregation, Cordiglione said. The archbishop accused police of standing by when the statue was damaged and claimed that the criticisms of Serra were unfounded. He also claimed that a written apology was insufficient. Acknowledging wrongdoing is the first step in restorative justice, he said in the statement. A simple "I'm sorry" falls pitifully short of reparation for the harm that was done. Throughout 2020, protesters in California toppled Serra statues in San Francisco, Los Angeles, and in Sacramento. The public scrutiny of Sarah reemerged in the wake of Black Lives Matter protest, denouncing institutional racism and police brutality, and led to the toppling of monuments on honoring Confederate leaders. Coeur d'Alene and Los Angeles Archbishop Jose Gomez issued letters staunchly defending the image and history of Sarah and criticizing those who defaced the statues. These responses galvanized indigenous scholars who called on the Catholic Church to fully admit to a history of colonialism that led to the loss of culture and land among the Native community. Our next article was published on May 26, and it is entitled DeSantis Spiritual Warrior Style, A Bid for Support from Like-Minded Pastors, by Jack Jenkins. On May 22, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis strode on stage in Atlanta and stood before a podium, silhouetted against a giant American flag. The crowd, attendees at a gathering of the National Religious Broadcasters, a Christian group, leapt to their feet. Some applauded, while others held up cell phones to record the moment. DeSantis began with a line he often uses, "Welcome to the free state of Florida," before launching into a stump speech recounting his proudest accomplishments as governor, such as removing books from public libraries and waging a war on woke. In his nod to his audience, he sprinkled his remarks with religious references, lauding churches that refused to close during the pandemic, and encouraging listeners to put on the full armor of God. As he closed, DeSantis gripped the podium and leaned forward. "We're proud of what we've accomplished in Florida, but I can tell you this, I have only begun to fight," he said. Technically, it wasn't a presidential campaign announcement. That would happen 2 days later when DeSantis joined Elon Musk for a glitch-ridden appearance on Twitter Spaces. But it was telling that DeSantis, who is Catholic, chose to speak to a largely evangelical Christian audience the same week he launched his White House bid. With growing uncertainty surrounding evangelical support for former President Donald Trump, DeSantis is courting one of the Republican Party's most sought-after constituencies, using a message that frames himself as a sort of spiritual warrior, a move that may attract faith leaders who traffic in similar rhetoric. DeSantis beta-tested this approach in November when the governor's wife, Casey, tweeted out an advertisement that framed him as a fighter. The ad featured images of DeSantis and his family, while a narrator, who observers noted had the feel of a mid-20th century Protestant preacher, declared, "On the eighth day, God looked down on his planned paradise and said, 'I need a protector.' So God made a fighter." Nothing similar has been produced by DeSantis' fledgling presidential campaign, which, only a few days old, does not appear to have launched a robust faith outreach effort as of yet. His team also has not assembled a list of religious advisors or endorsers, nor is there a sizable outside effort to drum up support among conservative Christians, such as the Pastors for Trump group that formed around the same time the former president announced his 2024 bid. But as the primary season begins in earnest, DeSantis may lean on an emerging group of culture warrior religious leaders and influencers who, while not yet endorsing him, have shown affinity for his approach to politics in the past. Among the governor's more vocal religious fans is Tom Askell, a firebrand, media-savvy figure known for leading a conservative wing of the Southern Baptist Convention. In November, Askell tweeted out footage of himself leading a prayer at a DeSantis event alongside the caption, "God has blessed the state of Florida by placing him in this office as his servant for our good." Askell, who pastors a church in Florida, later wrote about the prayer on his blog. He again heaped praise on DeSantis, saying, "He stands against the woke crowd and the intimidation and overreach of various federal officials over the last 4 years. He publicly lauded DeSantis, again in February, tweeting out a video of him standing in front of a podium with a placard that read, "Government of laws, not woke politics." "We need more governmental leaders like," the Florida governor Askell tweeted. The two men share a similar disdain for what they deem to be woke. Askell, head of Founders Ministries, has pushed back on what he sees as liberal ideologies in the SBC. And when he launched an unsuccessful bid to become the denomination's president last year, his supporters issued a statement in which they declared, "God is not woke." Religion News Service reached out to Askell to see if he intends to formally endorse DeSantis, but did not immediately receive a reply. Other Christian leaders, who are widely seen as conservative crusaders, have also expressed support for DeSantis' actions as governor. Bishop Joseph Strickland, a favorite among right-wing Catholics who has railed against COVID vaccines and been personally chastised by Vatican officials, has tweeted praise for DeSantis on multiple occasions, such as when the governor signed into law a ban on instruction having to do with gender identity and sexual orientation from kindergarten through third grade. More recently, Strickland, who oversees the Diocese of Tyler, Texas, celebrated DeSantis for pushing back on pandemic restrictions, such as vaccine requirements at public schools, saying, "I pray Texas Governor Abbott and other good governors will follow your lead." Not that DeSantis' style hasn't run afoul of some conservative-leaning faith leaders. When Florida lawmakers passed a law earlier this year making it easier to sentence someone to death, a practice condemned by the Catechism of the Catholic Church, the Florida Conference of Catholic Bishops urged lawmakers and the governor to oppose it. DeSantis signed the bill into law anyway, and his immigration policies have raised the ire of many Latino faith leaders in his home state. It's unclear whether DeSantis can convince evangelical surrogates to cross the Rubicon between unofficial supporter to formal endorser, the way Trump did in previous campaigns. That may prove difficult this go-around for both men. Texas pastor Robert Jeffress, an evangelical leader who has long supported Trump, told RNS in November that he does not intend to throw his support behind anyone during the Republican primary. But other evangelical leaders have simply held back on an official endorsement, leaving open the possibility of backing DeSantis. The Reverend Samuel Rodriguez, head of the National Hispanic Christian Leadership Conference and longtime Trump advisor, told RNS he is not endorsing yet, although he's willing to serve as an advisor to candidates to advance an agenda of life, religious liberty, and biblical justice for all. Rodriguez has praised DeSantis, but also been critical of some policies. In May, Rodriguez urged the governor to oppose an immigration bill that invalidates driver's licenses issued to undocumented immigrants in other states. Meanwhile, the Reverend Franklin Graham, who has vocally backed Trump for years, has also said he plans to avoid endorsing any candidate during the primary season. But he did pause for a brief photo op with DeSantis ahead of the governor's appearance at the NRB conference. He later tweeted out commendations that frame DeSantis as a fighter. "I appreciate the governor's clear voice and that he takes a stand against the evil that is trying to overtake our culture," Graham tweeted. Our next article is an opinion piece published on May 26, and entitled, "Young People Aren't Buying Far-Right Religious Beliefs," written by the Reverend Serene Jones, president of Union Theological Seminary. Far-right politicians and influencers are on a rampage to impose their views on all Americans. They're pushing for book bans, unfettered access to guns, anti-LGBTQ plus legislation, abortion restrictions, and more, all in the name of God. These sorts of hate-filled biblical interpretations might appeal to politicians' bright red bases, but overwhelmingly, at the ballot box and beyond, young people are showing us that they will not buy into them. Quite frankly, for far too many young people, religion means embracing weapons that kill their peers. It means stopping them from having control over their bodies. It means restricting people from loving who they want to love. By and large, young Americans don't want to be part of that. They want to join communities that provide safety, support, and acceptance. Just look at some of the purportedly Christian messages young Americans have heard recently. This month, Missouri State Representative Brad Hudson, a pastor and the sponsor of a looming bill to ban gender-affirming care for minors, said that he would advise adults seeking to transition to embrace the way that God made them. North Carolina Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson, who has launched his gubernatorial campaign, recently stated that God formed him to fight against LGBTQ plus rights, and that flying a rainbow flag in a church is a direct spit in the face of God Almighty. Days after a shooter slaughtered 3 children and 3 adults at the Christian Covenant School, far-right influencer Charlie Kirk said that gun deaths are worth it so that we can have the Second Amendment to protect our God-given rights. And as state representatives debated a draconian 6-week abortion ban in Florida, several lawmakers cited their religious beliefs to support the bill. Young people are wholeheartedly rejecting these messages. In recent months, young people have spearheaded major protests to condemn a wide variety of far-right efforts, like loose gun rules in Tennessee and the silencing of trans lawmaker Representative Zoe Zephyr. Young people also showed up in unprecedented numbers to resoundingly elect a pro-choice judge to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Simultaneously, young people are going to church less often and increasingly consider themselves religiously unaffiliated. In fact, recent data shows that nearly half of Gen Zers have no religious affiliation. That's no coincidence. They simply don't feel like they can connect with traditional faith institutions. In fact, a brand new survey from PRRI found that 30% of people who switch religions said that they were turned off by the religion's negative teachings about or treatment of LGBTQ plus people. Far-right leaders know they're losing with young people. But rather than re-examine their religious messages, they're doubling down and hoping censorship will save the day. They're banning books, stopping truthful discussions of their history, and pushing religion in public schools. Yet, more unchristian displays of power. The reality is, young people are open to faith and spirituality in some form. Fortunately, beneath the screams of far-right Christian extremists, there is a religious movement that supports progressive, inclusive policies, and it's growing stronger. For example, a few weeks ago, thousands of Catholic nuns wrote a letter calling for the full inclusion of transgender, non-binary, and gender-expansive individuals. Many faith groups are also fighting against the scourge of gun violence. At the school I lead, Union Theological Seminary, it's clear that students are clamoring for faith practices that align with their progressive values. Our students, who identify with many different faith traditions or as spiritual but not religious, are focused on dismantling racism, protecting our planet, supporting LGBTQ plus communities, and other social justice goals. All the while, they're supported by the message of love and justice from the Bible and other sacred texts. This year alone, we've hosted a number of inclusive events, like an evening of singing to cultivate peace and harmony with renowned Buddhist Venerable Sister Chan Kung, a symposium to foster collaboration between Black churches and LGBTQ communities, and annual ceremonies to honor members of Union's LGBTQ graduating student body. Young people can see through the facade of restrictive policies clothed in the guise of religion. And thanks to them, we can move toward a world that God and the Bible actually ask us to build, a world of love, respect, and acceptance. Now an article published on May 26, entitled Faith at Work Conference Builds Momentum on Religious Inclusion in Workplace, by Adele M. Banks, Washington. Naomi Kraus, a senior content strategist for Google, still recalls the childhood experience of seeing a relative coming home from work with his yarmulke not topping his head because he could not reveal his faith at work. Kraus, now the head of the technology company's Interbelief Network, said Jews like herself and people of other faiths can face discrimination on and off the job. But, she said, they also feel greater acceptance through faith-related employee resource groups, or ERGs, that are growing in prominence in Fortune 500 firms and smaller companies. Having members of the community tell their own stories is powerful, said Kraus, a speaker at the 4th Annual Faith at Work Conference on May 23 at Catholic University of America. It's even more personal when these are the people you work with day in and day out. It is very hard to hate the people that you know. The conference, which included a disclaimer that all who appeared on stage were speaking personally and not on behalf of their organization, was a mixture of testimony and training. In the audience were attendees wearing religious garb, like a yarmulke, a turban, or a hijab, while another occasionally said amen in response to speakers' remarks. The conference brought together Christian chaplain networks, human resource staffers, and members of ERGs that can include people of faith and no faith. Brian Grimm, president of the Religious Freedom and Business Foundation, said its conference drew more than 250 people, with 50 companies represented, more than half of them Fortune 500 firms, such as Dell Technologies, American Airlines, and professional services company Accenture. We do have very strong evangelicals, and we have the whole variety of every other faith, and everybody's working together, said Grimm. Outside of these kinds of walls, you hear that there's just sharp divides between evangelicals and others, the culture war divides, but you don't see that here, he said. Over the three-day conference, presenters gave a number of examples, including stories from the digital company Equinix, whose Faith Connect interfaith employee group worked with all of the company's other ERGs to raise awareness and funds to counter trafficking. In a breakout session, Mark Whitaker, an executive at Coca-Cola Consolidated, touted the hundreds of people who annually had become new or recommitted Christians after meeting with corporate chaplains or attending prayer groups at the Butler's distribution and production sites. In an interview, Whitaker said that he usually attends conferences of Christian groups focused on religious inclusion in the workplace, but he also appreciates the range of perspectives expressed at the Faith at Work gatherings. It is important to learn from other faiths, said Whitaker, vice president of Culture and Care at Coca-Cola Consolidated and leader of its T-Factor initiative, whose purpose is to transform workplace cultures around the world for good, for God, for growth. Grimm said the Faith at Work movement has grown since the first conference was held in 2020, weeks before COVID-19 shutdowns. The network grew as companies that had started ERGs met monthly online to share examples of the ways they were working to welcome such groups. Likewise, Groups representing faiths ranging from Hindus to Sikhs to Latter-day Saints started meeting virtually and saw their attendance grow and continued online even when employees headed back to their offices. Tim Schabel, a human resources contractor for metal coating company AZZ, said the use of spiritual advisors from the Marketplace Chaplains organization was one of the biggest tools in the toolbox to help employees when they needed a listening ear, including during the pandemic. At a session titled Providing Spiritual Care Saved a Company, he read a portion of a report received by a chaplain from someone who appreciated their ministry. "It has been hard to work from home and homeschool my son. I feel overwhelmed a lot, but when you text and you offer to pray for me, I know I can do this." Quoting guidelines from the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, North Carolina-based lawyer Jeffrey D. Patton offered tips on how companies can remain within legal lines as they seek to give people of faith space to express their religious beliefs and live out their spiritual practices. "You can integrate faith into every aspect of your workforce, but it has to be voluntary," he said. Patton said companies' approach to faith often boils down to matters of fairness. "I think it's incredibly unrealistic and, frankly, unfair to tell an employee that you have to check your faith at the door," he said. "If you're opening up your facilities after hours so people can stick around after work and use a room to draft a fantasy football team, then allow them to use that same room for faith-based reasons." Grimm and others attending the meeting looked ahead to ways to expand their movement nationally and globally. Marian Samintawala, a senior policy advisor in the State Department's Office of Diversity and Inclusion, spoke of the department's five-year strategic plan that calls for it to increase respect and a culture of accessibility for religious minorities and religious diversity. "It's a good sign, absolutely, because it shows we're not talking. We're actually putting it on paper and sharing it with the U.S. Office of Personnel Management and the White House that this is what we're going to do," she said in an interview. "Obviously, we talk about religious freedom abroad, and we also live or walk the faith at home." We have run out of time for today's episode of Religion in the News. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mary Grace Payden, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Religion in the News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Again, that number is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.